You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
He was terrified at how quickly it was moving. He feels he's let the genie out of the bottle. He had wanted a much slower, more measured reform, but no, it was spiraling out of control.
This is Cold War Conversations.
If you're new here, you've come to the right place for first-hand Cold War history accounts. And thanks to financial supporter Jack Veselak for providing today's intro. And make sure you hit that follow button in your podcast app so you don't miss out on future episodes. In August 1989, a group of Hungarian activists did the unthinkable. They entered the forbidden militarized zone of the Iron Curtain and held a picnic. Word had spread of what was going to happen. On wisps of rumour, thousands of East Germans had made their way to the border between Hungary and Austria, awaiting an opportunity, fearing prison and surveilled by lurking Stasi agents. The stage was set for the greatest border breach in Cold War history. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union, the so-called end of history, all would flow from those dramatic hours. Drawing on dozens of original interviews with those involved, Matthew Longo's book, The Picnic, An Escape to Freedom and the Collapse of the Iron Curtain, reconstructs this world-shaping event and its tumultuous aftermath. You can buy the book through the links in the episode notes and help support the podcast. Or if you listen in the first week of publication, do check out our book giveaway, also in the episode notes. I'm delighted to welcome Matthew Longo to our Cold War conversation. Prologue. Laszlo gives me a tour of what is nowhere. How did the East Germans even find this place, he wonders aloud. It is Annus Mundi, he says. The asshole of the world. No one knew about this part of the borderlands. On maps, only the line was represented, but not the vast stretch of no-go zones that comprised the Iron Curtain, the militarized frontier that emerged after World War II, dividing Europe between East, Soviet influence, and the West, American influence. If the full boundary system wasn't shown, the logic went, people wouldn't find it. Thus, the reality of the border was itself divided. For the military, the border regime was precise. For the average person, it was mysterious and threatening. Laszlo takes me to the edge of the woods. We follow the tree line down a slope through tall grass. When we round a bend, a clearing opens up. This is where the picnickers parked, he says. The field on which Laszlo and I are standing was the site of the Pan-European picnic, held on August the 19th, 1989, on the Austrian-Hungarian border, a giant open-air party, celebrating European togetherness and freedom, which furnished the stage for the greatest breach of the border in Cold War history. Hundreds of East German refugees dashing towards freedom, the initial tug by which the entire Iron Curtain would unspool. Or as Helmut Kohl, Chancellor of the newly reunified Germany, would later put it, where the first stone was removed from the Berlin Wall. That's an excerpt from the prologue of Matthew Longo's book, The Picnic, An Escape to Freedom and the Collapse of the Iron Curtain.
I came at this as an oral history project. In fact, when I first heard about The Picnic, it's interesting, I don't come at this from a Cold War background. I'm not a Cold War historian. I actually come at this from an interest in borders. I'm a political scientist, and I've studied borders now for most of my career. And when you're in this slender border world, in a way, you think you've heard all the great stories, right? Like you think you've heard these amazing stories of escape and capture and, you know, of heroism. And it's a high drama field, borders, as anyone who follows contemporary politics recognizes. But when I heard this story, I was blown away that I hadn't heard it before. And the reason I pursued it is in part because I knew the people, the actors involved were mostly living. And therefore, the kind of book I could write wouldn't be a history in the blow-by-blow sense, but something quite different, right? Born of these unique personal histories. So in a way, that was the origin story of everything. I don't think I would have pursued it had I not thought I could do that kind of oral project.
And those are just the sort of stories we love on Cold War Conversations. So you've got the right audience here. Where I'd like to start is if you could give me a brief description of the political situation in Hungary in 88 and 89.
So it's a little bit difficult, certainly for lay audiences, maybe people who've read about the Cold War, even lived through parts of the Cold War, to understand Hungary, because Hungary was quite exceptional in the sense that it didn't fit the normal or natural binary between a free liberal West, a somewhat clamped down, unfree Soviet bloc or communist bloc. Because Hungary was by 88, certainly, but had been for a while a bit of a hybrid in the sense that there were already economic reforms, there were already political reforms, and it was seen certainly in the East as something of a socialist paradise where there was good food, there was wine, the weather was nice, which is nothing about the economy, but helped with tourism. But people felt as though they could be themselves. People were already speaking in this way in the mid-80s, early 80s, that Hungary was a place you could go to be yourself. And then you'd go back to the GDR, you'd go back to Bulgaria or somewhere, and you'd feel more clamped down. And so Hungary, to start, for those who don't know Hungary in particular, you have to sort of get out of the classic Cold War mindset. And so what Hungary looked like in the late 80s, it was a place of reform, and specifically with the rise of Miklós Németh, which is the prime minister whose life story I largely track in the book. He was the last communist prime minister of Hungary. He came into power in the very fall, November, December of 88, and had a very clear reform project, which is that he wanted Hungary to pursue a multi-party democratic path. Now, for as much as Hungary was already a socialist pasture, right, it was already this place that was a beautiful place to live, that was an incredibly radical kind of reform. And it was a kind of reform that, as he would later say directly to Gorbachev, which I recount in the book, would require the communists to accept that there could be elections that they could lose. And if they lost, they'd have to leave, right? This is really, he really had a very strong democratic vision. And so this is the person at the top, and that's not quite true, right? Because the fact that your prime minister says nothing about your power in the party and so forth, I mean, there are many different versions of power, which we can get into, but at the very least it says something that there is such a strong movement of reform within the halls of power also. We should also mention Imre Pozsgai, who was the minister of state alongside Németh, another reformer. These are two very, very influential figures of this era. Late 88, early 89. So whereas Németh was doing things in the formal legal sense, the biggest thing that Pozsgai did, or the most important thing that Pozsgai did, he actually did in an informal sense, mostly through the radio channels, and particularly talking about 1956 and forcing the Hungarian public to rethink what 56 meant.
56 or 1956 was when the Hungarians rose up against Soviet occupation and were defeated by a subsequent Soviet invasion.
In particular, that, I mean, we now often think of 56 in heroic terms, right? The idea that these were freedom fighters, street fighters, who were fighting against what was a pretty draconian kind of rule from the Soviet puppets in charge in Budapest. But at the time, that was not spoken about, right? Because, of course, the people in power were those people, right? Who were the ones suppressing the student and popular, but mostly student, at least in the outset, revolt. And so you have Németh and Pozsgai at the top. And then you also have already in 88, all of these movements. They're not parties. They cannot run for office. There is no multi-party democracy. So obviously they can't run for office. But they're already acting like parties. They're mobilizing large quantities of people. And in the book, I follow mostly the MDF, the Hungarian Democratic Forum. But there were lots. I mean, I guess most famously we now know because of the rise of Orban, Fidesz. Anyways, if the question is about stage setting, that's the way I would capture what it felt like. It felt like there was some uncertainty about the power at the top, where some reform was possible. No one knew exactly what that meant. It wasn't like it was communicated. This was in fact true around the East since Gorbachev's rise, but it was especially true in Hungary. And you have already popular mobilization, even if not totally formal, right? Like halfway between formal and informal, let's say. And that came to a head in March 89, right? So the address of Pushkai was the winter, it was January, February. And in March, you had big popular rallies in Budapest. And so at both levels, both the street level and the governmental level, you're feeling real change. But of course, always the story with change in any kind of autocratic state of any sort, even a relatively liberal one, is always the question of how far is too far? Where's the line? When do you find out if you've crossed it? And so that's the feeling of those late 88, early 89 months of opposition groups trying to figure out where that line is.
I have heard Hungary described as the happiest barracks in the bloc. It was probably the most relaxed of the Eastern Bloc countries. But with Nemeth, he's got this rivalry with the party leader, Gross, and he's almost been set up to fail here. He's almost been set up to be a fall guy because they're in a quite bad financial straits, as is most of the Eastern Bloc as well. And I think it's also worth mentioning that there's Poland going on in the background, where Solidarity has been legalized again and is about to enter into semi-free elections with the communist government as well. So that there's these two countries almost in flux simultaneously.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say one thing about Poland, which is that I talk very little about Poland in the book. I mean, it comes out here and there. I mean, you have to. It's the other reform state. A lot of the challenges that Hungary was facing, Poland was facing, not just vis-a-vis Gorbachev and the Soviet Union, but also in particular different scenes with Ceausescu and Romania and so forth. But I talk very little about Poland in part because I didn't mean this to be a corrective book. I really just wanted to tell the story of the picnic and this incredible moment in the fields outside Sopron. But it felt like when I started to do all this reading about 89, I mean, there's so much work about Poland. And I felt that when I looked for work on Hungary, there was very little. And so in a way, it became something of a mission of mine to correct that narrative, to say that there were these two pictures of reform. The one gets so much press and the one gets very little press. But no, of course, I don't mean to diminish anything about the importance of Poland. In fact, the Polish roundtable and the Polish elections, all of these were motivating factors. If anything, there was a feedback loop, right, between the reform movements in Hungary and the reform movements in Poland, both clearly aware of what the others were doing and feeding off their gains.
What is Gorbachev's view of what's going on in Hungary? How does he feel about reforms and changes there?
So Gorbachev this is a general statement about Gorbachev, but Gorbachev is certainly with the vantage of hindsight, walking a very precarious line, right? So it's a very liminal position, Gorbachev's position, in the sense that he wants reform, but he wants reform off of the norm as it was set and understood in the Soviet Union. He actually doesn't want reform in the sense that Nemeth wanted it, right? There was quite a difference in their vision, in the sense that Nemeth really wanted a post-communist future. And this is something Gorbachev didn't want. He wanted a reformed communist future. He wanted to go back to communism of Lenin and the idea of a functioning communist state in which one can have development and degrees of political freedom without having the liberalism of the West or democratic elections in the free sense. And the cleave with Nemeth then is quite considerable, in the sense that Gorbachev was worried, in fact, in hindsight, Gorbachev was correct to be worried, that all the things that Nemeth had in mind would end up being a death spiral for the whole communist system, that it couldn't sustain, that reform, in the Nemeth sense, would be revolutionary. And that was not at all what Gorbachev wanted. what I found, part of the interesting bit of the research of the book, aside from obviously learning more about Gorbachev than I'd ever known, was specifically in threading the difference of these visions. You know, in general, until you get into the details, political visions often sound very similar, right? It's very easy to put Nemeth and Gorbachev in the same camp. And I think that's true in any kind of political context with which one is only mildly familiar. As I said, I have to stress on a podcast like this, I'm not a Cold War historian, right? This is not, I came at this as someone with a different interest, but of course I've since, you know, now spent years obsessively reading on this particular subject. I now care deeply. But on the outside, Nemeth and Gorbachev looked the same to me, right? They didn't have a way of differentiating them. And one of the interesting things is, of course, when you start to talk to these people, of course, I didn't get to talk to Gorbachev, I should stress, but Dr. Nemeth, for him, it was crystal clear the difference in their visions. And I find that interesting as a person learning about this story, because once that became clear, and once 89 happened and communism fell apart, you start to commiserate more with some of the forecasts Gorbachev had put out. In a way, Gorbachev was really correct in his concerns about Nemeth, just as Nemeth was correct in his hope for Hungary, so to speak. And that, we can talk about that later. But but there's obviously a difference of vision.
So Nemeth is sort of grappling with the financial situation that Hungary is in, and he is obviously looking down the budgets, and he comes across some, presumably some line items regarding the cost of maintaining the border between Hungary and Austria, the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, precisely. So there's a couple of things to say about that. So Nemeth was a trained economist, right? So his training in Hungary was at Karl Marx University. This was he rose to the top flights of the Hungarian state entirely on his record as an economist. This was not the, in a way, it was like, you know, you think about the worst versions of the apparatchik story and the way bureaucracy works. This is the best way a bureaucracy could work, that the brightest minds of economics end up trying to reform the economy of the state. But consequently, he had, at this point, years and years of experience looking not just at the problems of the economy in Hungary, in particular issues of debt, but also the way that the state was cooking the books, right? I mean, there was explicit illegality and dishonesty from the state. And, he settled on the idea that the way forward would be to have sovereign borders. And, there are two sides of that story. The one side is a simple trade story. You can't sustain an economy if you can't control the value of the things you're either trading in or trading. You have no control over that, which they didn't. But the other side, and this is what you're hitting on, is about the actual border, not the border in the abstract sense where one sovereignty ends and another begins, but in the physical sense. The Iron Curtain was this incredibly expensive terrain. We're talking about kilometers wide, heavily armed zone. In the 50s, it included landmines. At this point in the present, it was mostly electrical wire and soldiers and dogs and watchtowers and so forth. But in particular, maintaining the electricity was so expensive that Nemeth had a brilliant insight, which is that the first aim about sovereignty would be really hard to try to convince anyone of. I mean, Hungary wasn't just going to declare its sovereignty against, you know, Soviet wishes. But the second claim, this comparatively, at least seemingly small claim about the funding of a border wire, right? This seems like a manageable issue, was something he felt Gorbachev would understand and that he could communicate. And so when he met Gorbachev in March of 89, he took this secondary proposal, but he saw that the secondary proposal was the ticket towards the first one. He couldn't say the first one, right? But that was the strategy. Start with the second, start with the seeming issue that, frankly, anybody could understand, right? The electric wire was too expensive. Hungary was in debt. They said Nemeth's position was rather simple, wasn't even get rid of it. It was, if you want it, you pay for it. To which Gorbachev said, look, your border's your problem. And that was that. Within a month, they started rolling up the wiring. Because the wires, even if it seems, again, it seems like a small issue, were costly. Why were they costly? Because they had become so frayed. They went off all the time. They no longer effectively predicted human passage into the borderlands. And you had essentially a borderlands with border guards constantly going out to check what the wires were all the different alarms and alerts produced by the electrical wiring systems that were mostly dead animals. And it was too costly and also dangerous for border guards to be doing this. And so he takes us to Gorbachev, and Gorbachev says, okay, you do it yourself. He immediately starts unrolling it. But the reason it was a brilliant strategy is that Nemeth understood in an incredibly clear-minded way, once you start dismantling the Iron Curtain, the pathway towards the sovereign end he sought, in a way becomes visible, let's say, even if it's still distant.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And when I think back at Nemeth was a, or is a, he's still living, a brilliant political strategist. Nemeth saw something that I feel, yeah, very privileged to have learned, because I really feel edified by it.
Yeah, I love the fact that he decides to turn off the electric fence the day after May Day. So I'm presuming he's expecting all good communists to be nursing massive hangovers at that point. And he has a press conference announce this, and he's still sort of somewhat concerned, because he's worried that Gorbachev may be overthrown by hardliners at some point as well, isn't he? He's concerned about other Soviet reactions to this.
Yeah, Nemeth is terrified. He's done something shocking. I mean, starting to unroll the electric fencing of the Iron Curtain is a shocking use of political power for a prime minister in 1989 Soviet bloc. And he's scared from both ends. He's scared internally that there will be an attempted coup or an attempted assassination, that the party will say, this man is a liability, let's get him out. That would come from Gross or someone else amongst the party hardliners. That's the one side, that's the internal fear. And the external fear is that all that goodwill he had with Gorbachev, all this kind of tolerance that Gorbachev showed towards this incredible provocative end, would end up leading to Gorbachev's ouster. What happens if Gorbachev gets removed by someone stronger, someone more hardline behind him? The first thing that would happen, Nemeth felt, and I think totally reasonably, is they would make a show of the kind of person like a Nemeth in Hungary. And Nemeth was terrified. This was, in fact, when you talk to him now, he talks about all the different things that happened in 89. There was a lot of moments like this. But that feeling of uncertainty between those two poles, right, was crushing to him. It was a crushing fear.
These moves towards further reform are sort of pushed further forward with a ceremony on June the 16th, 89, when Imre Nagy is reburied, who was the leader of the Hungarian government during the 1956 uprising. And what is the reaction of the hardliners in the Hungarian Communist Party to the fact that he's being sort of exonerated for, you know, what happened in 56?
Yeah, so this is this parallel track. Right. So on the formal track, you have Nemeth talking to Gorbachev, dealing with Gross. And then there's this informal track where there's a connector between the regime, the government, which is led by Nemeth, and the opposition groups. The bridge between them was this man named Imre Pozhgai. Now, Pozhgai was the one who was very, active in changing the narrative around 56. This was something that was impossible to talk about from 56 up until 88. So much so that, in fact, 88, when they tried to do the exact thing they would do in 89, they tried to have a reburial of Nagy's body, Everyone was dispersed by police with batons beating them, right? So the story of the turnaround really is it's like whiplash inducing, right? I mean, 56 to 88, in a way, all those years are the same on this story, right? There is no discussion in Hungary. It is explicitly disallowed to talk about what 56 meant and the legacy of the violence against Hungarian citizens meted out by the government. And then starting in 89, already with Pozsgai's radio address, and then carrying through in March in the protest when very provocatively, a quite famous poem from the 1950 that was banned in 56 was read aloud by a student in a march in Budapest. And now up to June, it really is, this is the aspect of the account that is blow by blow, right? I mean, it is month by month, story. On June 16th, you have the culmination of that line, right? Not the formal line that Nemeth and Gorbachev are dealing with. This informal line, we're talking about radio addresses and poetry and opposition and so forth, with the reburial in Mladenovic's body. And we're talking about a reburial in the full sense. His body was exhumed and celebrated in being buried, not in an unmarked grave, but in a marked one that was allowed to have, would be recognized as such. And it is at this day that, aside from all the obvious symbolism and the power symbolically of what's happening, that we also have the introduction to the political scene of the person who would now become the most important person in Hungarian politics, and certainly the most recognizable name to most of your listeners, which is Viktor Orban. Viktor Orban gave a speech in which he said something that, again, at the time was unimaginable. Even 2 months earlier was unimaginable. Certainly pre-March was unimaginable in 89, which is to the explicitly state, Soviets get out. But it was an incredibly powerful moment in Hungary. We're talking hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking a new leadership forming and becoming present. And in particular, people being able to say things out loud that for, you know, the 30 plus years since the massacre of 56 would never, ever, ever, ever have been said out loud.
The momentum sort of continues because in 27th of June, there's a meeting with the Austrian foreign minister and his Hungarian counterpart who symbolically cut the border fence, highlighting the decision to dismantle border surveillance.
Yeah, it's a great moment. So we talk now, if we zoom to the present, that we're kind of obsessed with data or big data and the world of technology. And how everything is fake now, because everything is all about the visual, it's the optics. And certainly with AI, there's this fear that everything becomes fake, photographs and video, etc. One of the nice things about reading history is you realize that this, was, of course, was always true, right? It was always true that politics was about optics and imagery, and a lot of the things we think of as real or solid were always politically manipulated. June 27th is a brilliant example of this because you have these two foreign ministers, Horn, who will become very important later in Hungary, and Mach in Austria, holding a comically sized pair of scissors in front of the electric wiring. It's a big moment as they bilaterally cut the electric fencing. Even the assumption behind the image is preposterous because, of course, it wasn't a bilateral decision at all. Austria had no role in this. But the optics, of course, are great. It looks bilateral. There's the East and the West. Sure. But the part that's phenomenal about it on a purely, the pure cynical view of politics sense is that they actually had to, because so much wiring had been already taken down, they had to put wiring back up for the photogram. So what you're seeing is two men purporting to cut a wire bilaterally when in fact the wire had already been cut. It was rebuilt for them to cut it ceremonially in a decision that was never bilateral. The whole thing is farcical, but such is politics. And it was an incredibly effective, powerful image, right? Of this, again, this gets back to what I consider to be the brilliance of Nemeth's insight, which is once you start dismantling the Iron Curtain, you're going to set in motion something that's going to be very difficult to stop. And that image on June 27th is an exemplar of that feeling.
The other nations of the Warsaw Pact can see that as well. They can see that this is dangerous. And by coincidence, there's a Warsaw Pact meeting on July the 6th, where they all get together in Bucharest. And one of the many surprising details, which I didn't know in the book, was the detail that Nemeth and the Hungarian government's delegation ended up sleeping outside in the garden of their residence. Can you just tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's already, so the scene, I mean, I think we've said it already in this conversation, it's obviously a tense moment. The part that I want to highlight here is it really brings up how radical what Nemeth was doing, because whereas any country can itself reform, but most of the time the reform that's happening within a country is limited within that country's borders. But when you start to attack what is essentially a shared border, the Iron Curtain is something all the states of the East in a way depended on, the closedness created by it, you're not affecting only your own country, you're affecting everyone. And the feeling that what Nemeth was doing in this case was threatening the very ground on which all these states essentially, all these leaders walked, was prevalent in the room. Now, to set the stage, Ceausescu, who throughout the book is a bit of the anti-hero, the aggressor, that's not a crazy comma general for anyone that knows anything about the Cold War. I mean, Ceausescu was also, frankly, a maniac. But in this particular story, because of the particular relationship between Romania and Hungary, and of course all the Hungarians living in Transylvania, Ceausescu has a particular villainous role. So the fact that it's the last Warsaw Pact is serendipitous. The fact that it's in Romania is in a way, if you'd seen it in a Hollywood movie, you wouldn't believe it. Like, it's too perfect. That, of course, could have been anywhere, right? It had to be here, in the place where there's already been a year of antagonism between Romania and Hungary, where the Romanian-Hungarian border is already being remilitarized by Ceausescu in June. There's rumors of a war between the two states. There have been assassination attempts, or at least rumors of assassination attempts, by the Romanian government against people like Nemeth. So the tensions is already intense. And then you have this moment where the Warsaw Pact, which, as we now know, is literally dying, this would be their last meeting, it comes to Ceausescu's house, so to speak. And Nemeth is persona non grata in a way, and shows up at the villa given to his delegation, and finds that, because of course he doesn't go in first, right? He's the prime minister. He sends in a team of people to check the room, obviously for things like bugs, something quite banal in the Soviet era, but in particular, they have a machine to determine radioactivity. We're not talking about radioactivity in the sense there'd be a bomb, like something would blow up. It's actually just that there's a level of exposure that sustained time in such a place would be ultimately fatal. And they find out that the amount of radioactivity is so high that Nemeth isn't even allowed into the premises. So fortunately, it's July. It's a balmy summer night. And he and the whole team sleep outside. But that gives you a sense of what we're talking about. This is not a meeting of people who are a little bit upset with the course of reform. This is not a genteel difference about vision, right? This is a murderous difference of opinion. It really shows the true colors of the regime in Romania.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And unsurprisingly, at this meeting, Nemeth is verbally beaten up by the whole cabal, really, aside from Gorbachev. Gorbachev appears to be just sitting there watching. And at one point, you describe Nemeth looking for support from Gorbachev, and he glances over, and Gorbachev just gives him a wink, which I just thought was a lovely, lovely image.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful way of understanding how politics works. That in a room, so given the climate of essential, you know, of murderous intent, where Ceausescu is hectoring, he's yelling, he's stamping, he's banging the table. There's all this big ticket violence, I mean, this kind of high drama. And yet the real power is something so incredibly subtle. This little powerful gesture where Nemeth is Nemeth is concerned he's not going to come out of the room alive. And that's not, that's not overstatement. I mean, he might not have made it out of the hotel room alive, right? This is not some kind of writerly flourish to make it seem more dramatic than it was. This is clearly a scary situation. I mean, also, we should add that Nemeth is the youngest person in the room. He's really green in political sense. A lot of these people knew each other for decades. This is not, he's really, honestly terrified, and he's not sure where he stands, except that he believes, right? He believes, he has no evidence, but he believes that if things really got worse, Gorbachev would protect him. And so he looks to Gorbachev for any sign, knowing there isn't going to be some grand declaration of support or anything like that. And Gorbachev just gives him this tiny little subtle flick of the eye as a gesture to say, look, I hear you. I understand what you're going through. You'll be okay. And it's such a profoundly moving moment in what's otherwise a really terrifying, profoundly unmoving scene. I will say one more thing about it. My favorite anecdote from all of this is the not just the hectoring and the yelling. Of course, we know what Ceausescu's saying. But there's one little bit about how he says it, which is that he refuses to call Nemeth comrade and refers to him as Mr. Nemeth in that sense, incredibly patronizing way. But it also cleaves clearly the difference between what was happening in Hungary and Poland, as someone like Ceausescu would have thought. Because in Poland, the kinds of reforms happening in Poland which could have galvanized an opposition in Romania, but they themselves would not have changed the state of power in Romania, the state of the economy in Romania. And the Polish delegation referred to as comrades. What Nemeth was doing was so different, right? It's really a different thing when you start to open what is essentially a shared border in one territory. It gives you a sense of how much I can say easily that it's so powerful and important. But it really distills how much Ceausescu saw that this was an existential threat. It was a reform that was different than other kinds of reforms. And I think that's really clarifying.
Probably one of the countries that's got the most to lose if the borders opened is East Germany, because Hungary is an immensely popular holiday destination for East Germans. With Lake Balaton, it's an opportunity for them to meet their West German relatives in a relatively, relaxed country from a security point of view, although the Stasi does have its own office in Hungary and is monitoring this closely. So, this opening of the border could and will destabilize East Germany. So the situation at this point, there's loads of East Germans on holiday in Hungary, and they start to hear about plans for a picnic on the border. Now, how does this idea of this pan-European picnic originate?
June 20th is the start date. We're talking in Debrecen now. Debrecen is all the way east in Hungary. That's an important detail because the Iron Curtain, of course, by definition, is the far west of Hungary. But this is also one of those place-setting, time-setting moments in a conversation, because you have to understand that we're a short drive away at this point from what is now Ukraine, right? But then was literally the Soviet Union. It was the site of the largest Soviet base in the whole country, right? This was the hub. I think I at one point knew the exact drive time to the Soviet Union, but it's an hour, under an hour, whatever it is. It's on the border. And Debrecen it's also on the Romanian border, I should add. And Debrecen is not anywhere near the capital. It's also not anywhere near where any of the historical power or money ever was in Hungary. In Hungary, the country really is bifurcated with Budapest in the center, where everything west of Budapest was showered with the wealth of the ages of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Habsburgs and so forth. And the moment you go east of Budapest, you essentially go east. You really are outside of even Central Europe. You're in a place that feels more discreetly connected to Ukraine and Romania and so forth. And it's outside of the wealth and power. It's also outside of then information. Because whereas now anybody anywhere has access to information everywhere, you really have to imagine, if you're trying to understand this story, especially when we're no longer talking in the big geopolitical sense, the big power sense, that everyone we're talking out in Debrecen didn't know anything. They had no information about change, no information about all these different things. The only information they had came from the fact that if you were a young person and were interested at all in politics, you might have joined one of these party, not parties, right? These non-political party organizations that would, of course, soon become parties. So there was this kind of information desert. The reason that's important is it's so powerful when events happen in such a context, because events become information sources. And in this case, on June 20th, what happened is a politician, an important European politician in his own right, Otto von Habsburg, but specifically in the Hungarian sense, because this is what would have been the heir, right, of the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, had it not folded. And importantly, Habsburg spoke Hungarian, which for a European politician is unheard of, right? This is a man that grew up in an old Europe in which Austria and Hungary were already linked. And he comes all the way to Debrecen in a way that most European politicians wouldn't, to speak to Hungarians about his vision of a relatively borderless Europe, of European togetherness. And he finds, first of all, a packed room of students desperate to hear these things, right? I mean, you can imagine how a hungry student would be, like, desperate to hear this kind of, in a way that we don't have equivalents these days. There's no equivalent of the amount of power a person giving a speech in a place like Debrecen would have had. And a select group of people, amongst them, these are people that came from the people who organized that von Habsburg would come, particularly Lukács Szabó, and organized a small gathering in the evening where the people got together. One of them was Ferenc Mészáros, who's in a way, the main character of the story. That's not quite true. I don't think there is a main character, so to speak, but in a way, because he's the originator of the idea of the picnic, he's something like the main character of the story. Mészáros is there, listening to all these people talk about freedom and free expression and these exciting ideas, which in Hungary are already shocking, but in Debrecen are doubly shocking. And at one point, they start talking about reforms of the Iron Curtain and the border. And Mészáros has this idea that says, you know, it's fine to be doing this in a room with this fancy heir to a once great empire, over, you know, a fancy dinner. But if we're serious, that doesn't do anything. If we're serious, we have to go to the border. If you want to change the border, you go to the border. And he had this idea, which even now sounds slightly wine-soaked. I'm sure everyone was having a good time at this part of the evening. Why don't we throw a party? Let's throw a party at the border. Even saying it, and I've said it now, this is 5 years I've been researching this book, even saying it again 5 years in, for the 5,000th time, it still sounds ridiculous that you would think, I know how I'm going to bring down the Iron Curtain. Let's get beer and, you know, sausage and throw a party. But this was his idea, and it was, in fact, completely brilliant. It was completely brilliant in much the same way as Nimitz's insight was brilliant, which is, sure, the party's not going to change the world. But the party might normalize the idea that the Iron Curtain was no longer a beast as it had been imagined. It would change the image of this institution in a way that could change the world. And, you know, so it's easy to dismiss it because in a way it's dismissible. It's absurd. It's completely absurd. In fact, Ferenc had come out of the theater and his love was absurdist theater. The whole idea for him was absurd. Its point was to be absurd. Anyways, he gets basically laughed out of the room. And a week later, there's a meeting of the MDF in what I think is still maybe one of the most moving moments in the story. When he comes up, at this point, he can't let go of the idea. He brings it to this party. And it takes a lot of confidence to bring it to the party, you know, soberly in the light of day, this idea. And he basically gets laughed out again. And it would have died. It would have died then and there because it was over. It was absurd. He tried and it was laughed at. The party basically told him, look, we're a real party. We're trying to be a real thing. Don't waste our time with your juvenile ideas. And yet he found a partner, which is this woman named Maria Philip. And she says, look, I'll help you plan it. Let's do this. And it's really a quite wonderful thing that they, the two of them together, not just against all odds and against lack of information and money and all the danger inherent in the border, but also against the mockery of your peers, which to me is the more moving part of the story, which is that it's not just that it was an impossible dream and in some ways an idiotic dream, right? I mean, they had no money. What were they going to do? How are they going to do it? Organize a party 400 kilometers away. You couldn't do that easily now, right? It's like if you had no money in the middle of the UK, you're not throwing a party 400 kilometers away. That's insane.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
But I find the point about ridicule the more profound one, which is that it takes a certain kind of person to be not just face the odds of a state that might kill you or imprison you or something, but face down your peers, your putative revolutionary friends, and go it basically alone. And I find that really moving even still.
You know, this sort of highlights the amazing cast of characters you have in this story. And this is what brings it alive, because you go into a lot of detail about their experiences, and you talk about, how Maria manages to get through on the phone to people who she would have no right to normally speak to. She's this phenomenal character who manages to, organize this and get it all together. And amongst those other characters, I just want to highlight a couple of characters that you've got in there. I think, you talked about that being really moving. I think one of the stories that I found really moving was the story of Katia and Oscar, who had met, I think they were 17, and they met on separate school trips to the Soviet Union. Katia's from East Germany, Oscar's from West Germany, and the only way that they can get together is to meet in Hungary, and that's an amazing story. You've got the various different East German families who are involved, their stories about how they get across the border, how they arrive there, and there's a lot of twists and turns in those stories as well. And you've also got one of our guests involved in this as well, Laszlo Narzs from episode 52, where we described his life in Hungary, which reminded me that I do have a further section of his interview, which I haven't yet published. So do watch out for that. But if we move towards the actual picnic itself and how that unfolds.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the truth is that once the idea is hatched, it's only about 6 weeks of planning before you start to get to the picnic. And you have, at this point already, because of Nemeth's reforms, the Iron Curtain. Remember, the way we're talking, I mean, these two strains of narrative are actually contemporaneous, right? So the border cutting of Mach and Horn is roughly contemporaneous with the idea for Mészáros. The meeting in Ceaușescu's Romania of Nemeth he's roughly contemporaneous with Maria opting in. I mean, they're all happening at the same time. And it then starts to move very quickly after everything moving very slowly in July and August in the planning, especially once they team up with Laszlo Magas and go to Sopron, because then you're literally at the border. But the reason it's important to highlight the contemporaneousness of these events is it means that already after the beginning of the rolling up of the electrical wire, people in East Germany start to understand what's happening, which is that, again, these optics, these ideas that are unimaginable until roughly May 89, start to spark ideas around, you know, not just East Germany, around the whole Eastern Bloc, but especially East Germany. As you said, East Germany certainly had the most to lose by opening up the Iron Curtain. The most obvious example of this comes from the Berlin Wall, right? What was the Berlin Wall designed to do? It was designed to keep East Germans in. And they were relatively effective. We love to say that walls don't work, but of course walls can work. And in Berlin, it really did. The fact that it took a whole Stasi apparatus to make it work, I mean, there's reasons we can talk about the comparison, but the point being that the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain, and this is in this sense the inter-German border, were an effective tool for their purpose in this period from 61 until 88. And the pressure valve off that system was that while East Germans could not go to West Germany and they could not go to the West, they could at least go to places within the socialist East that were still desirable, places like Hungary, like Lake Balaton, and so forth. But of course, the only reason that works is because there's an Iron Curtain. And so the whole Berlin Wall structure is essentially built on the foundation of the Iron Curtain, the foundation being that East Germans could go to a place like Hungary where they also could not leave. The moment this starts to become shaky as a foundation in May, you have basically East Germans around East Germany looking at each other and saying, maybe this is our chance. Applying for visas to Hungary, planning trips to Hungary, which was anyways normal, nothing was going to raise flags. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of East Germans anyways traveled to Hungary as tourists every summer. And hey, it was summer, right? It was June and July. And obviously the narrative, because this is mostly a narrative history, is following a set of families, mostly families, also solo travelers, but mostly families, from the hearing of the news in Hungary from May, through the hiding of the plans in June, and ultimately through getting in the car in July and August, going down to Lake Balaton or Budapest or wherever, and then within Hungary, started to make their way to the border. Because importantly, as of August 1st, the tent areas, the campsite areas outside of the capital and towards the borderlands were also open to East Germans. They'd always been closed. So the actual action of the story doesn't take place near Lake Balaton at all, but instead near a place called Fertorakos, which is this little Hungarian town on the Nyíregyháza, which is this other kind of lake that dips between Hungary and Austria. And the campsites there, which are now open to East Germans and suddenly filled with East Germans. Because while the picnickers are planning their party, which still, even though specifications have changed, involves setting up a band from, a bandstand, having, sausage and goulash and beer. Contemporaneous with this moment where they're organizing a party in the defunct lands, the just rolled up, de-electrified lands of the Iron Curtain. Now you have kilometers away, really, really close, thousands and thousands and thousands of East Germans waiting for the opportunity to get to freedom.
And as part of this picnic, there's going to be a symbolic opening of a border gate that's been closed for, 30, 40 years.
Right. So to go back to the incredibly charming, I still find, vision of the picnic from Mészáros in June, the original idea of the picnic was there would be a border that's like a comic book version of a border where there's like a line and a fence and you can just wave to Austrians on the other side of the fence and you can kind of pass them sausages and that's the party. It was literally going to be Hungarians on one side and Austrians on the other. Obviously that can't work. But of course, the Iron Curtain is kilometers wide. I mean, it's insane to think that. That would be a person who, of course, didn't have information, which of course makes sense of what we've been saying. But through Maria's phone calls and her essentially manipulating the border guards to her whim, is able to work it out. They get a permit, not just for the place of the party, but also for a one-time only border crossing of this little road that literally had been closed. It's for 4 decades since the Iron Curtain became, right? So this is an unused road. It's actually not even a road. It's kind of like a dirt path, but it had a fence and it was guarded and it had a fence that would never been opened. They decided they would allow, because remember, Austrians or people from the West could come to East, right? It's just that East couldn't go West. So Austrians could easily come to Hungary, provided there were visas and paperwork. And this is all the stuff Maria's organizing for this insane window of time. Lots of phone calls, lots of letters, basically paperwork. So that a delegation, that was the word they used, of Austrians would come across this border, would open this border for the picnic. But what that required was it required breaking this enormous, powerful lock, which had closed the gate for 4 decades, and replacing it with a tiny little one that was there for show. This little gold thing that they were going to open ceremoniously. It was going to be this big. Look, it was going to be the same photo optic in a way as what happened on June 27th. Another one of these examples of, look, Hungarians and Austrians coming together. Look, we're just going to open this gate. But of course, what happened is this, again, in the profound ironies and flips and turns of the book, of the story, the gate would end up becoming challenged. It would begin to becoming the source of the escape. And part of the reason it was so easy to push through was because of the tiny little lock they had found. So the old lock, which might have actually been able to stop people from crossing, that had been gotten rid of for the sake of Austrians going east, suddenly became the tool that enabled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of East Germans heading west.
So 600 or so East Germans managed to hustle their way through that gate and cross over the border that day. But in following days, the border is closed again. This isn't the actual opening. It is a symbolic moment, and the border is closed.
Yeah, exactly. So the interesting moral decision that the border guards make to basically not put up any resistance to these Germans, to let them pass, is part of the drama of the story, right? The fact that you have, it's fine to say there's a party and there's going to be 20,000 people celebrating nearby. It's fine to say there's all these thousands of refugees and families in these campsites. But ultimately, whether they get through and whether they get through bloodlessly comes down to some decisions and the decisions of border guards to not even try, not to shoot in the air, not to tell them to stop, to basically step aside and let them through. And that's kind of a exciting, euphoric moment, but it really is a one-off. I mean, it happened. So we're talking about 600 or 700 people crossing at that instant, about 3 o'clock on August 19th through this particular gate. But then the gate was closed. But throughout the night, all around the borderlands, people already had been trying and getting through. But then after the 19th, specifically the 20th and 21st and 22nd of August, the evenings are filled with just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of East Germans pushing their way through, trying to cross, stepping through different layers of barbed wire, trying to avoid capture and so forth. And this proceeds, more or less unabated for weeks, right? You have this movement of people going into the borderlands. It comes to a head on the 21st in the evening when a refugee, is killed. It is taken to be an accident. I have no insight into whether or not it was an accident. I can't comment on that, but we generally accept it to be an accident. Sounded like there was unclarity and a bit of a skirmish and a gun went off and the shot was fatal to Werner Schulz on the 21st. And this particular event is important because whereas there had not been bloodshed prior to that and all these hundreds of people getting through is actually something, as we know, as we've talked about, that people like Nemeth and Pozhka were very excited about. It was great that the Iron Curtain was dealing with these breaches. They were encouraging them. But the idea that either border guards could go rogue or that accidents could happen and lead to international incidents or activating Soviet presence in the region and so forth was exactly what Nemeth was scared of. And so you have this basically unsustainable position where they're telling the world there's a law, while the law enforcers are quite actively not enforcing the law. You know, these are people who are actually helping the refugees in certain contexts, not just not hurting them. My favorite version of this is when the Hungarians would hold in their pockets little folded pieces of paper with an arrow on it, because they felt they couldn't say things to these Germans without getting in trouble from their superiors. But they can kind of show them where the border was, like show them where to head. These like little, again, it's all these levels of informality. It's informality upon informality. We're talking about law enforcers. This is law enforcement. Not even certain it's there anymore. They're not even certain what law they're enforcing, which leads to huge issues within the ranks. You have lots of stories of people fearing their commanders. The commander might be more hardline than they were, or so forth. And so they're all making these little tiny moral judgments all the time. Should I help the refugees? Should I help them explicitly or implicitly? If I want to help them, how do I help them? How do I help them in a way that avoids my own capture? So little things like not saying anything but pointing in a direction becomes commonplace. This is exactly what Nemeth is worried about. And so it's within a few weeks of the picnic that on September 11th, at the crack of midnight, Nemeth issues an order to open the border. And then we really do have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of East Germans leaving freely across the border. And then, as we well know, within 2 months, the Berlin Wall falls and everything's over. And everything in terms of travel restriction changes. Because one of the profound lessons of the book is that once you open up the Iron Curtain, the whole idea of the Berlin Wall falls apart. And this gets back to that initial insight of Nemeth, and also gets back to what, even though it was absurd, was so powerful about the ideas of Ferenc and Maria, which is that you really can trace a through line from how an institution like the Berlin Wall, which we're not talking at all about East Germany in this discussion, we haven't really talked about it. There were lots of reasons East Germany was falling apart. But the simple institution of what the wall was, it completely lost its foundation in a matter of weeks.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. I mean, when you spoke to Nemeth, was he expecting things to move this quickly, or did he think this was going to be over a longer time period?
No, and in fact, Nemeth was terrified at how quickly it was moving, because Nemeth realized very quickly, in fact, he, again, throughout this, he's very aware of what he's doing. He knows how radical this stuff is. But he feels he's let the genie out of the bottle. And he had wanted a much slower, more measured reform. And no, it was spiraling out of control. And this becomes clear less in the events surrounding the September 11th opening, and more as we get towards October, November, and December of that year, when the Berlin Wall falls and so forth, and Hungary very rapidly starts to move towards a democratic future. When Nemeth, in fact, really strongly wants to step on the brakes and say, this is not sustainable. We can't, like, we want multi-party democracy. We want liberal reform. We want all these things, but they can't happen in 2 months. And by the time he tries to step on the brakes, it's too late. I mean, within 3 months, by March, there's already elections. Nemeth is out of power. The Democrats are in power. And everything that Nemeth was scared of comes to pass, which is that they don't have a newly reformulated economy. You're going to have all the problems that I think probably a lot of your listeners know about the 90s. And it's not just transition, it's privatization and the ways in which state firms were sold off. And, you know, this is getting a little bit out of the remit of the book. I talk about it a little bit at the end. But all of it is something Nemeth saw. And all of it is something that Nemeth would have done whatever he could to have slowed. But at this point, you know, the pick your metaphor, you know, the cat was out of the bag or whatever. The horse is out of the farm.
Yeah, and he's still got the taint of being part of the party.
Yeah, exactly. And so Nemeth becomes this sort of tragic figure to me, and which is part of why it's so profound to talk to him, and part of why he is the kind of, you know, he's the kind of person that makes sense of oral history, right? It's easy to say it's great to talk about, you know, the East German refugees that in a way are nameless. No one knows these people. They're unfamous. They're just average people. Part of what oral history does is it reclaims stories you'd otherwise lose. But the other thing it does is it takes people who are familiar names, at least in some sense, and gives a depth to their positionality that is outside of the strict factuality of history, the dates and names and so forth. And Nemeth represents that, because Nemeth, in a way, is the hero of a story that's not of his making, right? Like, he doesn't want to be the person he becomes and is put in a position he's deeply uncomfortable with and ultimately gets vilified, right? He's the communist. Even the last communist prime minister of Hungary is ultimately a communist. And as they move towards a democratic future, what can he be but the bad guy in that very simple Manichaean telling, which again, it's not, you know, we in the West are famous for these tellings. We know, you know, I grew up in 1980s USA, where the good and the bad, the liberal and the communist, the free and the unfree, I mean, it was all binaries. And Hungary never made sense of any of this. The whole way we began this conversation, Hungary never fit this model. And Nemeth in particular doesn't fit the model. So he becomes a tragic figure. He becomes the one for whom the change ultimately, you know, he's the one left behind by this change. And he gets vilified, and ultimately the systems that he predicted crash in the way he predicted. And that's kind of sad, because at least, you know, in the way you'd hope there'd be some kind of redemption. And I certainly hope that one of the positive aspects of the book is people will see a bit of who he was as a person, right? That's part of what you can do in this kind of book, because you really, as a reader, I hope, meet him, right? And you get a sense of how difficult his positionality is, because ultimately he ends up in the same liminal place as Gorbachev. He's towing this incredibly fine line between wanting a reform and realizing the reform that he wants will ultimately...
You spend a lot of time with him. You do get a really good insight into, or as good an insight as you can get into the man himself. How is the picnic viewed in Hungary today? Is it celebrated?
Yeah, hugely, but politically. So you have in Hungary, like in a lot of states, but I mean, certainly in a quite extreme form in Hungary, a very polarized political system where you have the old left who grow out of the communist tradition, notably through the man Horn, who was the foreign minister who cut the wire in June 89. There's a lineage of the left that maintains and has become, in a way, center-left or, you know, socialist or social-democratic or so forth. And then you have the right that every year becomes more nationalistic and more in line with a kind of xenophobic populism that's quite common in Europe as well. And of course, these two poles, there really isn't much of a center in Hungary, these two poles claim, in a way, their lineage, their origins from the same moment. Right. So the Horn lineage are the reformers in government, and the Orbán lineage are the reformers outside of government, the revolutionaries in the streets. And people who only passively follow Hungarian politics or even European politics find it shocking that Orbán, this man we now take to be this staunch right-wing figure, has this revolutionary past. But actually, he does, right? And he emerges from the same moment and has carved out a political space for himself, as did Horn. These are both classic political operatives in a way that they're both, as one of the more intelligent commentators that I interviewed for this book, a guy by the name of Oplatka, who unfortunately passed away 2 years ago, had a brilliant line about Horn, but it applies to Orban as well, which is that, you know, these people really are politicians, which is that if you ask what they stand for themselves. And both of these people have carved out a legacy of 89, and the border opening is central. I mean, this is part of the Hungarian legacy of the whole Cold War, is the opening of this border. So 89 is celebrated differently. The picnic has become a cause célèbre of the right, of Orban, because it was organized by the opposition, right? And so Orban, even though he wasn't the opposition figure, it wasn't Fidesz, it was the MDF. But that lineage, the lineage of the opposition in Hungary, claims the picnic. You know, this is what happens with power. You can tell the story as you want. I mean, we know that, you know, history is told by the victors and so forth. This is just that. We're now in an era in which Orban is reimagining history in a way that fits his image. Even as I say that, one can't diminish his real role in it, right? In fact, I think that one of the great take-homes of this for me, again, as someone that did not come out of this with either a Cold War or even a Hungarian history background, is that it's also shocking to me that this is where Orban came from. And one of the things that's interesting now when I listen to European news and the way that, you know, that the EU in particular, Brussels in particular, vilifies Orban, for full disclaimer, I live in Europe, I live in Amsterdam. It's very normal to encounter people that say things like, what is wrong with Hungarians? They've lost their minds for voting for Orban. One of the take-homes of the book is, well, okay, there's a lot of ideological disagreement you might have with Orban, but you have to understand what he signifies in this country. And you can't take people out of the legacy, the lineage, the history in which they, in a way, are packaged as an idiom, locally. So Orban, in a way, is difficult to understand for us in the West. All we encounter is his new xenophobia, his building of walls, and so forth. The question then is to say, well, there are the two faces of Orban. Face one is wall builder, anti-migrant. Face two is old revolutionary, the man that, you know, said Soviets get out. Rather than just talking about how discordant they are and vilifying Hungary Orban ourselves, the more interesting question is to bridge them, is to ask, how did we get there? Not just in the big sense we all care about, how did we get from the fall of the Berlin Wall to our new era building walls? This is the question that I've basically spent my career trying to answer, right? This is kind of where I come from. But in this specific case, how do we get from an Orban that tears down a wall to an Orban that builds up a wall? And the answer has a lot to do with the different ways people understood the big ideas of the time, things like freedom, right? There's a way that we in the West saw all these activists as being like us, right? The opposition, these students, they all looked great. They were talking about freedom and democracy, and they wanted all the things that we had. They wanted, you know, free markets, etc. And yet freedom is more complicated than that. And a lot of what's interesting about going back in time and understanding what people like Orban really say, their freedom was much more about something like self-determination. It really was Soviets out. And so once you repackage the calls for freedom in a sovereigntist language, not a liberal language, it makes total sense why the first threat Orban would face was the Soviets to sovereignty, to Hungarian sovereignty. And the new threat Orban faces to the same sovereignty, in his view, is the migrant. I don't think that's inconsistent at all. I might not like it, right? I might not share the ideological prior, but it's a consistent ideological prior. And so, you know, and this gets back to the merit of oral history, the point of understanding, not just what happened historically, but what people thought at the time, what things like freedom meant to them. Part of what's so brilliant about talking to all these Hungarian activists is being able to start, let's say, to parse these different conceptions of freedom embedded in their calls in the 80s, and then take that lineage to the present, not form-fit it to our own conception, which in this case doesn't fit at all.
The book is called The Picnic, An Escape to Freedom and the Collapse of the Iron Curtain by Matthew Longo, and it's published by Bodley Head. Please use the links in the episode notes to buy the book and help support the podcast. Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.